Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Our world is filling up with smart things, from the smart appliances in our homes to the smart vehicles on our roads. The trend is building towards smart, connected cities. The Internet of Things, as it is called, holds great potential, but getting all those devices to work together will be a challenge. Stephen Liang is the director of the Geosensor Web Laboratory at the University of Calgary. He's in Columbus today to address the issue of connectivity at the Ohio State University Center for Urban and Regional Analysis. For more information about that, you can check the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Stephen Liang joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my honor to be here.
When you had a baby, you experimented with creating a smart nursery. So that kind of starts out at a little bit of a micro level. Maybe you can tell us what you mean by the smart cities things by talking about a smart nursery.
Well, my research is always about how to empower anyone. Anyone means any citizen. So they can innovate by connect different things together using the internet, right? So when I had my baby before, you know, when we were painting the nursery, I was like, you know what? Let me sensor up the nursery. You don't know how to raise a baby. I know. Just put sensors in, right? So I put lots of sensors. Actually, I put two sets of Wi-Fi control lights. I have temperature. I have humidity. I have sound, so I know when the baby's crying. I have a video, of course. And then I was thinking to have heart rate sensor as well.
What kind of sensor?
Heart rate. Heartbeat.
Heart rate.
Yeah, so I know if the baby's still breathing or living.
Every new parent's fear.
Yeah, and then, yeah, it's very interesting. And I even enroll my baby into an open source Internet of Things competition. It's called Connected Babies. Yeah.
Yeah, so other people are doing this too. It's a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. But I found actually it's very funny. When my wife told me that, you know what, honey, can you turn off the lights? I have to, you know, get my smartphone and then to enter into two different apps just to turn off the lights.
Okay.
I was like, this is an issue. I just want to turn off the lights, right? How come it's so complicated? Because they have two different lighting systems, right? Two different systems. But for me, lights are lights. It shouldn't be in two systems. So actually, it's really, when we talk about this connectivity, right? I personally feel the pain. How to connect these different systems together rather than I have so many different apps just to have a smart nursery, right?
So did you figure that out?
Well, no, because I found, to be very honest, I found the baby's using us too much time. I don't have time to write a program to connect them all together. But what I do is in the smart cities area, right? That's my research and my company tried to do is how to have this seamless connection so we can build a smart city, act like a one city, rather than so many different systems, right? That's my actual research.
I'm always trying to visualize. We've talked about this many times on the program, and I'm always trying to visualize, what are we talking about? What would that be like? What would it look like? What would it smell like? And I always think back to, you know, science fiction movies I've seen. And one is where the guy's walking through a city, and everywhere he walks pops up, you know, advertisements, especially focused on him, kind of like what you'd see on the internet and social media and that kind of a thing, right? What are you talking about? Can you just kind of walk us through what you mean by a smart city?
So I'm very biased, right? Because I'm an Internet of Things guy. So
sure.
I give you an IoT, Internet of Things scenario. So in the future, everything will be connected to the internet. The question is, will it be done by you or to you? When I say everything, I'm saying light post, the bike path.
You mean, so I'm walking by a light and the light comes on?
Light comes on. Or if there's an accident, light post will call 911 for you, right? Yeah. So the smart light post, they can call 911 for you. They can pick up gunshots. They can collect PM 2.5 air quality reading. And you can even maybe charge your phone. So it's one of the example. It will be connected to internet. For example, bike path will be connected to internet, so know how many bikes passing through, right? Or is it busy or not? And then the smart cars, right? The car to go. You know where are the cars? And then think about, for example, the lights. We talk about lights. Mm-hmm. telephone booth. Right now, a lot of telephone booths, they are, you know, under some major renovation, become smart kiosk, right?
Okay.
Yeah, libraries, so library kiosks, they all connect to internet. And you just, everything, the infrastructure connect to internet, so you can get data out of it and to serve you, and then so you can optimize the processes in a city.
You're saying it's going to happen, how it happens. So is it going to happen to us, or are we going to make it happen for ourselves? Is that?
It's going to happen. So a lot of entrepreneurs and researchers are doing that, right? Actually, I forgot to mention about one of my favorite examples, the garbage can.
Ah, the garbage can.
Garbage cans. A lot of garbage cans actually are connected to the internet. I was in Brussels last year. I found somebody connect laptop to the garbage can. I was like, what are you doing?
Why?
Because think about it. Collecting garbage is very time consuming, right? When you go there, you don't know it's full or not. You just collect them. So it's not optimized. But if every garbage can has a sensor in it, you know how full are they. You can really optimize the route, when and where to pick up the garbage. So you don't need to have a set schedule. You always have the best schedule to pick up the luggage, the garbage. So it's always, it's
and
not
they
full.
Already do this in Brussels.
I think so. And actually there is a company in Boston, I think. They are selling this smart garbage can. Yeah. And think about the cities are wasting money to collect garbages, right? Just by routine. Oh, the other example I can give it to you is city of Edmonton. They spent Alberta. They spent $3 million just to mow the lawns. And if you look at how they mow the lawns, they have a set schedule. There's no data to optimize how they mow the lawns, right? But if they have the sensors and to have soil moisture to monitor how the grass they grow, they can really optimize. So the lawn always look beautiful, but they can have use much, much fewer resources just to maintain the lawn.
And you want it all to be seamless. Mm-hmm. How would that be? I mean, why not have a separate sensor for the lawn versus one on a telephone pole or on a light pole to call 911? What's the importance of having it all unified?
I think right now the smart cities or the Internet of Things is very similar to the time before we had internet. There were so many networks, independent networks. They don't share data with each other. But imagine like today's internet, right? You can freely share data, and a lot of innovative applications were created because it's free and connection. Right? So same thing for the Internet of Things. I think for smart cities and Internet of Things, the real innovation will happen when you can really innovate by putting different things together, like the lawn and the light post.
Uh-huh.
And the garbage can and the light post, for example. And new innovation will happen when we are able to put everything together. For example, like when there is a major disaster happen, right? Let's say hurricane or earthquake. You really need to know all possible information so to save lives, right? But if the light post, the garbage can, the light, the power, the transportation, they are all individual systems, it's really create friction for you to do like save lives in this example, right? But if you can really access this information in a seamless way, like the way we access different websites, you can really develop new applications, in this case, to save more lives.
I was thinking when you're talking about a hurricane or let's say a tornado or whatever it might be, what happens when it's all wiped out by a natural disaster? Are we going to depend too much on the interconnectivity of everything and not enough? I mean, and then I started to think about it more and thought, well, if it's wiped out, you know right away something's been wiped out. Go there first.
Yes, it's one way because to know nothing's there, like no connectivity, is a good information, right, in itself. And also we had this project with the Department of Homeland Security, and actually they do think about this situation, right? Because when there's a major disaster, the first thing go out is the network, right? So actually, like in this example, we have this local regional network, so they can create a ad hoc network just for when disaster happens. It doesn't depend on the internet. So when you have the network, the wide area network come back, it will synchronize with the cloud in the internet. And then so actually it's a network of networks. So actually there are ways to
get around
to make
that.
It happen. Yeah, exactly.
You worked on a project in Calgary that places air quality sensors around the city. Talk about how that project got started and what you've learned from it.
Oh, thanks. I love this project, yeah? So, okay, the idea is about this. I believe in smart citizens. It's a perfect storm, in my opinion. That means right now we have a very cheap and ubiquitous connectivity for the network. We have the cheap sensors, right? And the cheap electronics, CPUs, plus well-educated citizens. So all this together, actually, we can really empower citizens to do amazing things with the fraction of the cost right now, cost the cities to maintain an air quality network. So I have this idea, so let me prove it, right? So I just do this project. So we had this project workshop. We got 50 volunteers. At the very beginning, we were like, is there anybody interested in this? It's really geeky and nerdy. We got overwhelming responses, right?
People from geeks and nerds.
Yeah, actually. but they want to be part of it, contribute to society, right? So they bring back, they come, and then we let them to assemble the sensor by themselves. It's a very fun experience, right? We have a grandfather bring the grandkids to come and to put the sensor together. And then they brought the sensor back overnight with 20 times the number of air quality sensors in Calgary. Yeah, we used to have 3. Right now, we have more than 60 sensors.
And why is this a benefit?
Okay, it reveals a hidden phenomenon, which is in Calgary, it's like, oh, near the Rockies, right? The air must be good.
Right.
You know what? It is not.
Okay.
We didn't know. Right now, we have first time, we have a good number of air quality sensors allow us to monitor the distribution, the movement of the air quality. And we found actually on average, every, you know, there's about 3 to 4 days in a month, the air quality is not so good. You don't want to let your kid to go outside because whenever there are cars, you have pollution. So when the weather pattern is not good, the air quality is bad.
And the idea is that you have these 60 or so air quality sensors across the city that can show the movement, and you can actually say, okay, it's safe to go out now, that quickly.
Yes.
If they work together.
Yes. And actually, we are right now working on prediction. We found actually it's possible we can have a 90 minutes prediction because when the dirty air is moving from the west to the east, actually, there's about 90 minutes difference from the west to the east. So we can warn the people who live in the east, for example. They said, you know what? The air is getting worse. If you want to go for a morning run, do it now.
Okay.
Don't do it later. Huh. It's interesting.
Another project you're working on is creating smart shirts with sensors for first responders. What would those do?
This is a project to part of the DHS Homeland Security Next Generation First Responder Initiative. So the idea is you need to make the next generation first responder fully connected, fully aware, and fully protected. And in this case, the smart shirt is to fully protect them. And so we can monitor their health status. And then, so, you know, just an extra eye to see how I go in the when they are, you know, fighting the fire. And actually, it's very interesting, one very interesting use case in this case, which is actually the most important, one thing very important to protect the firefighters is to monitor their heartbeats, the heartbeat rates, when they enter into the fire and when they exit. And because actually the most dangerous time for them might be when they go home. They might have a heart attack.
Right. I've heard about that.
Yeah. So actually just to have a smart shirt on them actually really make them fully protected so they can focus more on how to save lives.
There's lots of cool ideas and lots of neat things to talk about, but some people are worried about Big Brother. They're worried about, like, as I described it before, you know, these science fiction films where everywhere you walk, you're being checked and monitored, and you have no privacy from that. You have no way to unhook from the connectivity.
In my opinion, I think the number one thing is we, as the citizens, we need to be aware the pros and cons, because it's going to happen. So we need to educate ourselves, right? The pros and cons about this kind of Internet of Things. And there are ways to protect privacy. I'm a techie, so I tend to use a techie way. So for example, if the system is more decentralized, that means you have the knowledge or the data is kept in a local area network, mm-hmm. and your privacy is more protected. But if it's sent to the cloud, and mm-hmm. then there's a big brother, I mean, the cloud knows, you know, the data. So there's always pros and cons. And the other thing is about the cost, right? A lot of things we do online right now, it costs nothing. But we are not naive, right? Somebody pay for it. So I think as a citizens, right, we need to know the pros and cons and the trade-offs about these privacy issues, and we can make our own judgment and decision which system to use and in what scenario. It's going to happen. We just need to be aware.
Stephen Liang, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Liang is an associate professor at the University of Calgary, where he's director of the GeoSensor Web Laboratory. He'll be speaking today at the Center for Urban and Regional Analysis at OSU. And you can check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides to learn more about that. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Last summer, the United Nations passed a resolution affirming that online freedom and internet access are human rights. Access to the web can be an important tool, but it is also vulnerable to cyber threat. And so the question becomes, if internet access is a human right, should governments around the world extend that right to cybersecurity? Indiana University Associate Professor of Business Law and Ethics Scott Shackelford recently addressed this question in an essay on conversation.com. Check out the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Scott Shackelford joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We were just talking about smart cities and interconnectedness and how it should all be kind of seamless and interconnected, but that we also need to be having the conversation now about what are our rights to privacy in a world like that. So first of all, the idea of internet access as a human right, where have we seen this taking hold besides the United Nations?
Right. This is an idea that's been around for a little while now. In fact, so long that some countries are now starting to actually make this part of their domestic law. So Spain, France, Finland, Costa Rica, Estonia, and Greece have actually passed laws at this point to make internet access a human right, at least domestically.
What about the United States?
Well, this was part of the conversation you might recall when we were discussing the net neutrality idea, mm-hmm. especially back in 2015 with the former FCC chairman, who was very much for, in this case, basically treating the internet as another type of infrastructure that we all really depend on to go about our lives in the 21st century. It's an open question of whether that designation is going to continue with the new FCC chairman, but treating internet access as a basic infrastructure that's vital for exercising our rights online is certainly an idea that's also had a lot of play in this country, too.
What did the UN resolution have to say about the issue as it pertains to the United States?
It wasn't actually country-specific. Yeah. As you know, the United Nations generally doesn't like to call out unless something's been quite egregious. So, for example, sometimes the United Nations gets involved when a government completely cuts off internet access to its citizens, basically denying them any type of free expression online. And we've seen that happen a few times. For example, you know, Egypt or Syria, that they've attempted acts like this over the years. But generally, this has been more of a general pronouncement that human rights are equally applicable both offline and online.
And so when you talk about, say, Egypt and Syria hindering internet access to curtail citizens' rights, what were they doing?
Well, in this case, so for example, shortly after, or really during the time in which the former Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak was overthrown, Egypt basically tried to cut off internet access into its country to limit the type of social media organizing that was helping to generate the citizen action movements in that country. Same thing with Syria, when we saw initially the unrest that were first off moderates before they became, you know, the insurrections that we see today. Mm-hmm. So this has been kind of a ploy that a number of autocrats around the world have used early on. It's difficult to pull off. Even in Egypt, which only had a few internet access points coming into its country, there were still ways around that.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, citizens could use their mobile phones and use virtual private networks or VPNs to get around the censorship, just like citizens in China do to get around the Great Firewall of China.
What's the argument against internet access as a human right? It was debated in the United Nations before it was passed. You wrote that some feel that technology itself is not a right, but a means through which rights can be exercised. What's the distinction?
Yeah, and it's important to point that out because there's still by no means universal consensus on this idea. Mm-hmm. So no less than the father of the internet himself, Vint Cerf, right, has argued exactly that the technology, the internet, that's not the right. It's just the avenue by which we can exercise our rights, for example, to free speech, freedom of assembly, things like that online. But the pushback to that in thinking about the cybersecurity context is, well, this is an increasingly central way that we exercise our rights. And if you take this avenue away, just like we heard, for example, in the Supreme Court yesterday with a number of justices talking about the social media rights of accused individuals, this is certainly a central structure in our civic community life. And without that, that's increasingly abridging these rights.
Okay, so what about the right of privacy? If we embrace the idea philosophically as the internet being a right, we have access to it, a right to access to it, then what about privacy? What sort of protections do we deserve if that indeed is a human right?
Good question, right? So back in 2013, the UN General Assembly, this was in the wake of the Snowden revelations, voted to confirm that what's called the right to privacy in the digital age. This was done basically unanimously, with a couple countries abstaining, but no country really voted against this idea. Now, how we actually go about defining privacy is certainly contentious. There's not even a common definition of privacy, for example, between the U.S. and the European Union right now. The old definition from way back in the 19th century of privacy being the right to be left alone, you know, it doesn't apply in the same way today as it did back then. We were much more concerned about the newfangled technology of photography than we were Twitter, right? So there remains to be some heavy lifting about what we mean by this and how, with each new generation and each new technology, our idea of privacy is changing.
How much is the issue of enforcement part of the conversation?
It's a big part. Now, so this is a common problem with international law generally, right? And this is really baked into international law. That's something that a lot of people don't understand. International law is really, first and foremost, the product of countries, what countries want to agree to and how they want to limit their own right of action internationally, right? So countries, shockingly, right, don't really like to provide enforcement mechanisms just in case they might be breached in breach later on of their agreements. Mm-hmm. So this is a big problem in particular in human rights law. So even though we have really fantastic treaties like the UN Declaration on Human Rights, mm-hmm. They aren't always honored, right? And because there's not these really hard-nosed enforcement actions, there's no executive sitting out there punishing countries that don't live up to their obligations, a lot of countries, unfortunately, wind up ignoring the rules.
What would it look like if we made cybersecurity a standard of human rights? What would it be like? How would the world change?
So this is a good question. I don't pretend to have all the answers here. The goal was really just to start a conversation, which I thank you for helping us do right now, because I think when we think about cybersecurity, there's a lot that we can do at all levels to make this a much more manageable problem, just like you were talking about with your previous guest in the Internet of Everything context, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot that users, that we can all do to help make our networks more secure, right? We can use stronger passwords. We can use VPNs. We can limit the types of links that we click on if they don't look quite right, even if they look like it's coming from your boss. It's always good to pick up that phone and question, especially if it's 4:30 on a Friday and maybe you don't want to otherwise, right? There's a lot that we can do at all levels. And I think human rights, kind of at the top level, is certainly a big piece of that. How we would think about operationalizing that idea, there's a couple of notions you can consider. For example, there's a growing movement on the part of a lot of companies to do something called human rights due diligence, to kind of bake in human rights decision-making as part of their corporate decision-making. Traditionally, this has been around things like conflict minerals, human trafficking, things like that. But we're starting to see some companies, especially in the critical infrastructure context, treat cybersecurity as part of that. And you can think about that because, you know, for example, if you're a grid company, if you operate part of the electric grid, yes, it's important to keep that network online for your company, but also for all the other companies and individuals who rely on you, right? Mm-hmm. So I think to the extent we start to treat this as more of a concept of due diligence, as corporate social responsibility, that could kind of help us move the ball forward here.
So there's corporate due diligence, but what about personal due diligence?
A good question, right? So, you know, so far we have a lot of rights that we're talking about. We haven't been talking about a lot of responsibilities that mm-hmm. go along with those rights online. It's tough because in an ideal world, we'd all have access and understanding of certain basic cybersecurity best practices. You can call it cyber hygiene, right? The digital equivalent of washing your hands. Right now in the U.S., our education system isn't that well set up to do that. Compare that to, for example, the U.K. The U.K. has a new initiative where every kid going through primary school there is going to learn how to code, right? And that's a great opportunity to instill some of these basic cyber hygiene ideas early on. We can do that on a kind of school corporation by school corporation basis in the U.S., and some are experimenting with that already, but it's going to take a lot more grassroots organizing to kind of push that idea forward. And some groups are helping to do that, like Girls Who Code. We just need a lot more of those efforts, I think.
You wrote that the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an online rights advocacy group, called for technology companies to unite in defense of users and protect people against hackers and government surveillance. What about the fact that at this point we pay for it? We pay for protection. Someone makes a buck off of this, right? You're saying it should be offered up to us free?
So the cybersecurity industry is booming.
Yeah.
Right? For example, just one company, JP Morgan, spent more than $100 million on cybersecurity in just one fiscal year, right? So this is a big deal for the big guys, but also for small and medium-sized mm-hmm. companies, right? So I think, yeah, the argument isn't that we need to, force all these companies to offer their services for free. That's not going to happen, right? But we do have some ideas that could be tried out there. So, for example, the country of Estonia is one of the most wired nations in the world and has been kind of at the cutting edge in this area for a while. And their government offers a suite of online antivirus, anti-malware products to all their citizens for free, right? Just some basic stuff that can help safeguard you from, for example, phishing or malware attacks, things like that. Even if we were just able to do something like that, I think that would be great. It's easier to do that in Estonia because we're talking about a country with a population the size of San Diego.
Right.
But you could think about how this could play out, if nothing else, on a state basis. So maybe some leading states who care a lot about this, like Ohio, potentially could help kind of show the way here, and maybe other states would follow as a result.
You know, it's really interesting. You're talking about Estonia. You're talking about the UK requiring coding in grade school classrooms. It seems like their whole attitude toward this is so much different than it is in the United States.
Right. I think so. I think there's more of a recognition that as we approach this Internet of Everything, there's so many opportunities replete in that. And if we don't prepare kids at the earliest stage possible, then we're going to be missing. We're going to miss the train, right? This is obviously important for our kids. It's important for all of us, though. I don't want to pass the buck on, you know, adults, young adults, old adults. All of us need to do a better job at this stuff. It's too easy not to. I mean, we see every day a new headline of a massive data breach.
Right.
And it's, I think, a sense of cyber fatigue can naturally set in, right? My one-year-old got a data breach notification the other day in the mail, right? I mean, it's crazy what we're kind of in the world we're at right now.
Why would your one-year-old get a data breach notification?
Isn't that incredible? Well, basically, she was on our insurance, and this was after the Anthem breach not too long ago.
Oh, okay.
And as a result, all her personal information was lost in there, too. So it is pretty nuts. Right now, we have a system where there's not a lot of liability attached to these breaches. So, you know, it's not the case, for example, where companies have their stock prices really hit after a cyber attack. If you look at Target, if you look at LinkedIn, if you look at Sony, all their stock prices recovered almost immediately, or if not just a couple months later after their attack. So until we start to bake in some of those incentives, I don't think we're going to start to see a lot of corporate behavior change, unfortunately.
What sort of technology and standards do you think are part of this new landscape that we need to talk about?
Yeah, so I don't want to be all doom and gloom. I actually wrote a book partly on cyber peace, so I think there's some possibilities here to make this a more manageable problem at least, right? And we have seen some important progress. So, for example, in the U.S., under the Obama administration, we had something called the National Institute of Standards and Technology's Cybersecurity Framework come out, which is basically a framework of best practices That was the result of collaboration from industry and government officials, initially for critical infrastructure providers, but that's starting to create a common vocabulary and a standard of cybersecurity care that companies can measure their own practices against. So that's a really positive development here in the U.S., and one that's actually being tailored and replicated around the world. A couple dozen countries are experimenting with their own versions of this framework now. And that's feeding into some progress on what we call norm building. This is creating new rules of the road for countries around the world with regards to cybersecurity. So the G7, the G20, the UN, even the UN Security Council, just a few weeks ago now, have passed resolutions calling for cybersecurity norms, particularly relating to critical infrastructure. So I think we can keep building on that progress, I hope, and maybe start to operationalize it and really talk about what we mean then in certain contexts like privacy.
Does it matter much what people at the top of the Trump administration think about all of this?
It does. It does, yeah. I mean, So a certain amount of this, now that the Obama administration has got the ball rolling, I think is going to continue, even if the U.S. decides not to participate. But a big reason that we've seen such an impressive rollout, I think, of cybersecurity norms was a big piece of leadership from the U.S. That really started with the U.S. and China coming together about intellectual property protections and trade secret protections a couple of years ago. That wouldn't have happened without leadership from the Obama administration. So I think without leadership from the top of the Trump administration, I don't think you're going to see progress necessarily stop, because there's a lot of leadership still from or the level right below that that's going to continue on regardless. But I think you are going to see a slowdown.
Because like the president doesn't use computers and that sort of thing, or is it the people he's installed at the FCC?
Well, a little bit of both. And if we talk about international, obviously this administration so far has shown a preference for bilateral relations, so nation on nation. This is very different from what we're talking about here. We're talking about groups of really different countries coming together, forming rules of the road for our common benefit. And so far, at least, there hasn't been a big appetite for that.
All right. Well, Scott Shackelford, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for the opportunity. Cyber peace, everybody.
Scott Shackelford is an associate professor of business law and ethics at Indiana University. We will have his article published in theconversation.com. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When it comes to tech, we're often waiting for the next best thing. Every once in a while, retro is that thing. Mobile phone maker Nokia is banking on it anyway, and its plan to recall the Halcyon era of the early 2000s with a revamped Nokia 3310. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
The model was discontinued a decade ago. Its new edition, they want to capitalize on the interest in a small, simple phone. We've been talking about that a lot lately. Tell us about the original Nokia 3310 and what made it a hit in the first place.
Sure. I mean, the big thing that made the Nokia 3310 a hit, when it was first released, it was fairly inexpensive, and Nokia had a very healthy reputation for phones that were durable and had, pretty long-lasting batteries. It was a very simple phone for sending text messages and making calls and not doing a whole lot else. It didn't have a color screen. It was all black and white, and this was, a very different time for phones.
So what does this new version have that the old one didn't? And, what kind of balance does it strike?
Well, so this is bringing, a modern camera, a color screen that is not a touch screen, but a much larger color screen. The same, keypad kind of layout, so that you're still sending text messages in very much the way that you were before. It's going to be available. The plasticky kind of outside is going to be available in several different colors. And they've managed to make the price considerably lower than the original 3310.
How much?
It's going to be right around $50 for people who want to buy it. And then you just plug whatever SIM card you want into it and it'll start working.
Okay. Well, that is cheap. It's going to have a camera, though, a color screen, and an MP3 player, right?
yeah, this is going to have, you know, a lot of the things that are, you know, considered important for a modern smartphone. It's going to have, you know, it's going to work with a data plan. It's going to have, it has a very basic web browser in it for searching for things. And there are going to be, you know, apps that are going to run on it. They're not going to be like you would think, you know, an iPhone app or an Android app, but you know, similar enough that, you know, you'll be able to use it for most things.
Who is this for?
You know, it's entirely possible that this is, you know, for someone who wants a backup phone or, you know, they want to get a child a phone. They don't want it to be a smartphone. And it's also, you know, a $50 nostalgia play. There are people, and I am unfortunately one of them, that are going to buy one just because, you know, it's a nice, you know, kind of reminder of the phone that we had when we were much younger.
People are interested in the fact that the phone will come with a classic video game called Snake. And I was just looking at an illustration of two guys playing it. And what do you remember that game? What was it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Snake is a game that's been around for a very, very long time where, you know, you use the up, down, left and right keys to move a single pixel snake. And every time it, you know, it captures a dot on the screen, it grows a single pixel longer. And so you just keep going until you, you know, run into yourself or run into the walls and die.
And this is a really big deal.
This is a game that occupied many, many hours of my teenage years. I'm ashamed to say.
It made you what you are today, Russell. It made you what you are today.
Probably true.
So you're one of the people that it's going to appeal to. But is there actually a real demand for simpler phones too?
You know, there is some, you know, interest in simpler phones. I don't know that it's a demand. We're still seeing, you know, constant and consistent growth in the smartphone market all around the world. But there are, you know, still developing countries, developing markets where, you know, not everyone feels the need to have a smartphone or can afford a smartphone. And so this is kind of an in-between, you know, where it offers some of the features of a smartphone at a you know, much more affordable price.
Yeah. Speaking of another throwback, BlackBerry has a new phone as well. The BlackBerry Key One will run the Android operating system. That's kind of new for the company, right? We've talked about it, I don't know, maybe a year ago.
This will be the third phone that BlackBerry has released running Android. Only this time, it's not actually BlackBerry the company. The BlackBerry brand has been sold to another company. So this is, you know, BlackBerry by name, but not BlackBerry the company that was, you know, based in Canada and doing things. This is that they're referring to themselves as BlackBerry Mobile, which is an entirely different business, basically. So this is, you know, BlackBerry has sold, you know, kind of the rights to their name as far as making phones go to this other company, and they are using the BlackBerry Mobile brand to release this phone. This phone looks and feels very much like a you know, what you would expect when you hear the word BlackBerry.
Yeah.
But it is you know, running Android and you know, has you know, modern processor in it and is designed to, you know, kind of compete in a world where people look at iPhones and Android phones and go, man, I wish I had a keyboard still.
Right, because it has the physical keyboard.
Right, and unlike BlackBerry's first Android phone, which is the BlackBerry Priv that had a keyboard that slid out from the bottom, this is a keyboard that is always on the front of the phone, just like most BlackBerry phones that ever existed, where you have, you know, two-thirds of the phone is screen and then the bottom third is keyboard. And this, you know, continues in that design.
How does it feel? Does it keep that feel of a BlackBerry for those who preferred that?
You know, holding it in your hand and using the keyboard, this very much feels like a BlackBerry. The keyboard is definitely BlackBerry's keyboard. There's no getting away from that. So if you've used a BlackBerry before, holding this and typing on it is going to feel very familiar. The software is entirely Android. So if you are familiar with, you know, the BlackBerry Enterprise server or any of the BlackBerry apps from a couple years ago, none of those are going to be the same here. There are, you know, BlackBerry Android apps that try and give similar experiences, but you know, this is still very much you know, Android, where apps live on the home screen and you know, you have a notification drawer up top, and things are very different from BlackBerry's operating system.
Is it still focused? Are they still shooting for the business clients?
This is definitely still, you know, the joke has been made around my office several times now that this is the phone that your dad would use.
Okay.
And that's it is someone who is, you know, who was comfortable with the BlackBerry experience, you know, so very much a business like person. But you know, unlike the last BlackBerry Android phone, this is not, you know, built entirely for enterprise users. It's really just someone who was familiar with that look and feel and wants to have it back.
So what are your predictions?
I hope that it sells a little better than some of the previous BlackBerry Android phones that have come out. It's priced a little higher than you would expect for a phone of this size. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, you know, right around $600, and you're buying it directly from BlackBerry Mobile, and then you can add it to any of the four carriers here in the U.S. But it's going to be a little on the expensive side, and it's not going to be, you know, right in people's faces, like if they walk into a Verizon store or something like that. So it has a couple of things kind of working against it.
Yeah. Unlimited data mobile phone plans. For a while, they were going away. Now many carriers are bringing them back. Let's start with Verizon, the biggie. What are they offering in their unlimited plan these days? What does that even mean?
Yeah, so Verizon used to have an unlimited data plan that was, you know, entirely unlimited. There was no, you could use as much data as you wanted, and you would never have any real consequences as far as how much data you consumed. Mm-hmm. It turned out that there were a couple people that were really good at taking advantage of that, and so Verizon kind of made those plans go away, and for a while had no unlimited plans at all, and that didn't work very well with some of the, you know, competing carriers offering things that, you know, kind of looked like unlimited. And so now there is a plan that Verizon is calling an unlimited data plan, in that you have unlimited access to the fastest speeds that Verizon can give your phone, up to 22 gigabytes. And when you reach 22 gigabytes, then your connection to the Verizon services have the potential to be slowed down considerably. To make sure basically that performance isn't negatively impacted for other users is the argument that Verizon offers. So to make sure that, you know, the network is, you know, running strong for everyone, you have this technical limitation where you reach that 22 gigabytes, and if Verizon deems it necessary, then they will slow your phone, your connection to the internet down, you know, very, very slow.
How will you notice?
When things stop loading correctly.
Okay. Well, how could they do that? That doesn't sound like an unlimited plan at all.
Well, so, you know, you have unlimited access. You just do not have unlimited speed is the argument that they use, because when they slow you down, you still have access to the network, and they're not charging you any more for the access. There's no overage fees or anything like that. You just don't have unlimited access to the quality of service that you would have.
Uh-huh.
The quality of service drops down, and this became, you know, very much a trend. T-Mobile and Sprint and AT&T all offer now, you know, basically identical versions of this plan with, you know, variances on price and things like that. But the bottom line is that you now have a certain amount of data that you can use to tether to things like laptops and tablets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and usually it's 10 gigabytes that you can use as a part of this plan. And then, you know, a bucket of, you know, between 20 and 26, depending on the carrier, gigs of, you know, kind of that unlimited 4G speed. And then once you reach that limit, then you're slowed down considerably, but you still have access to the network and there are no overages.
How many people does this really affect? How many people use that much?
Not a ton of people. You know, the Verizon and all of the other carriers have done a pretty significant amount of research and found that the number of people that go over 20 gigabytes for a single line in a month is a fraction of a percent of the total network. You know, I am a really active user, and unless I am trying really, really hard, I usually don't get much higher than you know, between 16 and 18.
Okay.
You know, and that's, you know, using my phone as a work internet connection, you know, but there are definitely people who, for the longest time, it was streaming video, you know, where, you know, they are traveling back and forth to work for, you know, several hours in a day on top of their work day. And so, you know, watching video through their phone became a big part of how, you know, data got consumed. And T-Mobile originally sought to fix that by, you know, by offering free video streaming if you were only using the lowest possible resolution.
Well, that's kind of yucky.
Right. And so, you know, but that was a thing that appealed to a lot of consumers, was that, okay, you know, they didn't have to pay as much. And the video quality took a hit in order to have this kind of free data. And so now there are these unlimited data plans where, you know, you don't have to worry about the quality of video service as long as you stay under that particular cap. And then if you do go over that cap, you can still, you know, make phone calls and send text messages and check Facebook. But you're going to find that the video quality, you're not really going to be able to do things like, you know, stream YouTube or something like that once the quality has slowed down.
What's AT&T's take been on this?
AT&T had their original answer to this unlimited plan was not great. It was significantly more expensive than the, you know, competing partners. And then they received a lot of kind of negative feedback from their users. And so just earlier this week, they released a significant update where they have, you know, up to 24 gigabytes is going to be, you know, included in an unlimited data plan. And then they also offer $25 off if you are also a DirecTV customer. So you gain extra discounts from, you know, other AT&T related services.
What advice do you give someone who's looking at all these plans? Like you said earlier, it ultimately doesn't affect that many people, but how do you decide?
The biggest thing is to pay attention to the details around each of these plans, and make sure that when you go in to have this phone set up, that it's being set up so that you are actually taking advantage of the unlimited plan. A lot of T-Mobile customers still right now, you know, have access to what is, you know, supposed to be unlimited high-speed data, but are still using the T-Mobile software that decreases the video speed or the video quality down to its lowest possible resolution. So they're not actually able to use this highest possible setting because they don't know to go into the T-Mobile app and specifically say, you know, I want to enable this, you know, this high quality video feature, because it's not on by default for any T-Mobile account.
Huh, interesting. So should go into T-Mobile and make them default you to the best, the highest quality, the highest resolution.
Yeah, it's all really about the details for each of these plans, is to make sure that once everything is set up, that you're actually getting to enjoy the service that you're paying for.
We just have about a minute left, but you also recently wrote about opting for alternative mobile carriers. What are you talking about there?
Yeah, so, you know, there are these things called mobile virtual network operators, and this is a really complicated thing. You know, you see it a lot in Walmart with Straight Talk and you know, these kind of customer service things that look like they are the same as Verizon and T-Mobile and Sprint.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, kind of how they sell it, is, you know, we're on the same network as T-Mobile, and so we can do this thing. But often there are some pretty significant compromises as far as customer service and quality of service, because they're able to buy this service from T-Mobile and AT&T and then kind of resell it to you at a discount. And so they're, you know, they exist, and a lot of them are really just not great. It's kind of the overall point that I made.
You're not really getting the same thing.
You're definitely not getting the same thing. There is definitely never a point in which you will have the exact same service as you would if you were from, you know, T-Mobile or AT&T or Sprint or Verizon.
Russell Holly, thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks a lot for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.